does have it all. All of our pre-owned vehicles are Hubler Q certified, which include a 128-point vehicle inspection, a free Carfax vehicle history report, and two warranties. A two-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty, and a 30-day, 1,000-mile comprehensive warranty. Visit any of our 13 locations today, or click drivehubler.com. Hubler has it all.
Welcome back to the drivehubler.com studio here in downtown Indianapolis. I'm here with Eddie Garrison, Jimmy Cook, and I'm James Boyd. You're listening to 107.5 The Fan. Obviously, we talked a lot about this Pacers-Bucks series in our first segment. We now have Jim Ozarski, who covers the Bucks for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, on the line. Jim, how you doing, my man? Do you get any sleep after a playoff game, or are you just wired like the players and you just stay up?
No, I didn't do much in that way. No, but it was fun though. After a game like that in particular, a transcendent performance. You come home, you got a little bit of a buzz. That's what it's about, right?
I do think that's what it's about. It's also about Dame time, clearly, because they brought him there to do that. And I just want to see, what was the reaction maybe post-game from that locker room? Obviously, they knew going into the game they wouldn't have Giannis, an MVP, two-time MVP, finals MVP, all the above. But they did have Damian Lillard. How do you think that maybe just reinvigorated and reinforced that belief that they can win without Giannis if needed until he's available to return?
You know, James, it's kind of interesting. I don't think they didn't have that belief, to be honest. Without Giannis this season, and now granted, he played the most games he's played since he was very young this season. So they had him for most of the year, but they had beaten the Los Angeles Clippers, Oklahoma City Thunder, and Orlando Magic without him. Obviously three playoff teams, and actually Chris Middleton missed a couple of those as well. I mean, Dame was kind of the guy in those situations. So for them, I don't think they've felt one way or another about it. Obviously, they're a worse team without Giannis. They all said that. But they definitely had a lot of confidence. But what I will say, though, James, is the Pacers had confidence, right? The Pacers came into Pfizer form knowing they can win in that building. And I think getting game one, protecting home court, having the best player available play like it, definitely, help things. And no doubt has them have the Bucks feeling a little better about themselves than, say, losing 8 of 11 to end the regular season.
Just one quick follow-up, Jim. I know you said the Pacers came in there knowing they could win, believing they could win. However, as the, opposing reporter or the reporter that's covering the team that is going against the hometown team here in Indianapolis, which is the Pacers, did you see them maybe get a bit shell-shocked with the onslaught of Damian Lillard threes where you're just like, okay, how is this possible?
I don't know if it was Dame as it was maybe the fact that it was a playoff game. And other than Pascal Siakam and maybe Miles Turner many, many moons ago, this was the first go-round for a lot of those guys. And Pascal Siakam looked like the only guy who was like, yep, this is what we do. So I don't know if it was so much Dame doing his thing as it was maybe just the overall, we've been off for a week, we've been waiting for this, it's a playoff game. There were some shots early by the Pacers that, for the Bucks too, that just missed everything, so long. You could tell they'd been off for a week and were just really amped. So I don't know if it was a Dame thing. I think it was more of just, all right, here are the playoffs, and some of those guys may be feeling that extra adrenaline.
Jim Ozarski joins us, covers all things Bucks for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and on a side note, this is the first time in my life I've had all variations of our name involved here. We got James Boyd, Jimmy Cook, and then Jim Ozarski all on one connection here on The Fan. Jim, which piece of the Bucks do you feel going into this week or going into this series was the most overlooked nationally? Because I will admit up front, I know how talented Chris Middleton is. I know how key he was to that run to the title that they made in 21. But going in, I thought to myself, you control Dame and you don't let Bobby Portis get 30, you're going to have a decent chance here. I guess Chris Middleton's my answer, but for you nationally, which piece of this Bucks team with Giannis removed was the most overlooked, and which piece of this team is the biggest factor if Giannis is to miss multiple games in this series?
Yeah, just briefly, I think your pick of Chris Middleton would be number one for me. Chris has been criminally underrated, even in his own home city, to be honest, guys, which is quite remarkable, but that's a whole other topic, I guess, for Milwaukee Talk Radio. But yeah, look, he was, what, 6 of 8, 15 points in the second half, effectively closed out the Pacers once they got it to 12. People tend to forget how good he really is. Real quick, guys, 21, 6, and 6, those are his averages in his last 8 playoff games since that finals run. He's a real
terrible
dude in the playoffs. real dude, you know, and on almost 50-40-90 splits. But now, broadly on a national level, look, I understand why Doc Rivers has the rep he does. But look, if there was this is not a referendum on his hire per se, but I would say the way the Pacers handled the Bucks for 4 out of the 5 games under Adrian Griffin really showed why the Bucks made that change. And so on that national level, I think people kind of forgot, like, this is why they hired Doc Rivers, and it was because he can raise the floor defensively. I have to imagine the Bucks, you know, the Rick Carlisle and his group and the Pacers saw a much more connected Bucks defense, a much more disciplined Bucks defense, and a group, frankly, guys, that knew what they were doing. Now, I'm not saying the Pacers aren't going to score 120 points Tuesday. They're not going to miss their first 14 threes, right? But the Bucks are a better defensive team than the Pacers saw way back in November, December, January, and I think that's what was lost in this. It was all about the record and these guys being hurt and people doing the body language police with Damian Lillard, but it was Chris Middleton's healthy. And Doc Rivers was hired to fix the defense. And while it's not dominant, it's better than it was.
Jim, going back to Damian Lillard for just a second, I stressed this multiple times last week, even though I still have, albeit maybe less confident than I was a couple days ago, Pacers in 6 in this series. I expected Damian Lillard, with what I feel like is the best assemblance of supporting cast that he's maybe had in his whole career, even without Giannis out there. I mean, some of those Portland teams with McCollum were really good, but I don't know. There's so many good pieces that he can work with that I feel like this is maybe the best collection of talent, but I also knew he was going to take over. Do you feel like that tone setting doesn't need 35 by any means in every first half of this series, but do you expect from an offensive flow standpoint that it is going to be much like those Portland teams as games start? Hey, Lillard's going to control this, and whatever he wants, he's going to go get.
You know, it is interesting. And you know, I asked him about that after the game, about not trying. What, he took 5 shots in the second half, didn't make any. And it was sort of like, well, why didn't you continue to force the issue a little bit? And, you know, part of it was the Pacers started doubling him at 93 feet, right? but he said that, and he has said that. This is the best team he's ever played on. He's like, Chris Middleton's over there. And again, on that national level, a 3-time All-Star NBA champion might not be very sexy. But again, that's someone who's done that. Brook Lopez, again, maybe not that sexy of a name, but Brook's the all-time leading scorer still for the Brooklyn Nets franchise. Like, if you need someone to go get a bucket, Brook can do that too. And obviously Bobby Portis got himself going. So look, if he comes out and hits 6 of his first 7 shots, they're going to ride that momentum. But if Andrew Nembhard isn't called for those fouls in game 2 and Dame is 1 for 7 to start, I don't think he'll have any problem sort of facilitating a little more and taking advantage of the attention in a different way. Because, yeah, you're right. Like, I think he has trust in all of those guys because the core of that group, you know, it's still intact from when they won a title in 21.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Jim, I know you haven't been to Bucks practice just yet, and I'm assuming you all will ask about Giannis and his status for game two. But just overall, were you able to see him? I know he was at the game, obviously. Did you see him, his interactions with his teammates, his spirits? What can maybe you glean from that to just see perhaps where his mind space is? Because having read, you know, or I'm reading right now the Giannis book and about his life and things like that, this dude will never miss a game unless he absolutely has to. So just to sort of see it eating at him, what has been your assessment of how he's handled that and maybe how he's tried to lead the team in other ways?
Yeah, look, he's definitely a little stir crazy. This is not – look, and he has missed games. He has sat out games. He's, I guess, more understanding, because I won't say accepting. He's more understanding of the medical process as he has gotten older. You know, but again, he's been hurt a lot of these playoffs. You know, 2022 against Boston was the last time he was fully healthy. Prior to that, it was 2019. I mean, he's unfortunately suffered some injuries that have knocked him out of games and limited him in the playoffs. So, yeah, he's you know, dealing with that personally. But now in terms of on that team level, look, he's still engaged. You know, he's not out for the – I mean, you know, he hasn't been ruled out for this series, depending how long it goes or, you know, if they advance. So, you know, he's still engaged in all that way. And he has taken on more of a vocal leadership role this year. This dates back to the, you know, under the previous head coach of Adrian Griffin. So he's still – part of that, right? But you're right. For the most part, though, it is eating at him that he cannot participate, which, again, I think if you're the Pacers, look, they've got nothing for Giannis. I think he's averaged, what, 45 a game against them the last 2 years, or this year maybe 36-plus the last 2 years. Most of his triple-doubles are against the Pacers in his career. So I think if you're Indiana, you definitely want to try to steal one Tuesday and get that momentum going to Gainbridge, because if Giannis is playing, that means he's cleared. That means he's healthy and ready to go. And I don't know if you're in game five, you want that guy being the one with the fresh legs, right? So we'll have to see how that plays out, though.
Jim, James brought this up in our first segment, and it's in that same line of thinking. Let's say, for the sake of argument, that Giannis does not go in game two. He is declared out, and it's just the same setup for Milwaukee that we saw in game one, and they win, and they go up 2-0. Does the ideology of it shift to where, well, we're up 2-0 right now, why not buy some extra rest for Giannis and not even think about rushing him back? Is there any mindset for that where if they go up 2-0, well, we're doing this without Giannis and we know how tough this playoff run is going to be, let's have him sit a little longer? Or do you envision once he gets any type of green light, they're going to throw him back out there?
Yeah, he's, to James's point, I mean, this is a guy who you're not going to tell, hey, you could play. But you know what? We're gonna let you hang back here and not. No. He's, put it this way: when he's cleared, he's cleared. So I think what they are doing, because this is a pretty severe, you know, soft tissue strain in that calf. He's a very explosive player. He's right-handed. That's his left calf. That's his launch leg. His spin moves, like, so. If he's cleared for game two, he's going to play. If he's cleared for game three, four, five, whatever. Like,
I guess I meant more like if he's 70% and they say it's close and he has that mentality like you've outlined, like James outlined, of no, I want to be out there at all costs. Are they more cautious with it if it's not a, yeah, you're fully green lit versus where the player wants to be like, no, I need to be out there these are the playoffs. What are we doing?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think if this was the finals, I would say, yeah, I think there'd be that sort of gray area of percent able to go. Like, look, I don't know how he feels. We don't know if they're imaging every day to track inflammation, you know, that kind of thing. They'll never talk about that, of course. I think it's either you're cleared to go 100% or you're not. Like, I don't think right now there are percentages in gray areas. You know what I mean?
Okay,
so
yeah.
So I think, look, even if they were down 0-2, would he be more antsy? Sure. if they're down 3-1, sure. But I think, look, they know, and I think he knows, if you were to just somehow come back early, let's just say, oh, I'm still feeling it, I'm a little sore, but now I want to go, and he restrains that thing, well, now you're talking, second round, Eastern Conference, like, they're in that spot now where I think it's either you're 100% or you're not playing. That's my opinion as they go forward in this series.
Jim, last one from me. Cash Money Middleton. Like, who came up with this nickname? Because I read this in your story, and I'm like, wait a second. I kind of like this because he looked like he was Cash Money, and I actually had no idea. I knew he was a great mid-range shooter. I didn't know he had the highest mid-range percentage this season, according to the broadcast yesterday. I believe they said he shot it at 59% this year.
Yeah.
But the nickname and just the confidence of that guy, what do these moments perhaps mean to him? Just knowing he's similar to Jamal Murray in a sense where he can get dinged up, you kind of forget about him, and like, is he as good as we think he is? And then he comes back in the playoffs, and you're like, wow, he's really good. He's getting older. How much does he appreciate just being able to go out there and perform at a high level at this stage of his career where he knows maybe he's toward the end rather than the beginning, and that window to try to win another one with Giannis is not as big as it used to be?
Yeah, I believe the nickname is very old, to be honest. I don't know if it goes back 10 years, but it's been with him for a long time because, look, earlier in his career, he was the one they drew up last second shots for. I mean, he up until this year with Damian Lillard has been the Bucks closer. Fourth quarter, yes, Giannis has the ball, but Chris Middleton at 16 feet, it's a wrap. You know, like that's how their playoff run started. He had a game winner turnaround jumper against the Miami Heat in game one. And then look, locally, guys, you know, he put up 35 and 15 in game three against the Brooklyn Nets when the team scored 89 points. That was Chris Middleton cooking to save their series, their championship run that year. And then Giannis gets hurt against Atlanta, and, you know, he scores nearly 60 points in the final two games. If they had invented the Larry Bird Trophy for Conference Finals MVP a year earlier, Chris Middleton has that on his mantle. You know, he's the one who puts up 40, you know, in game four of the NBA Finals. You know, that, like, this dude is, and that, you know, I mentioned his stats just in the last handful of years. He's that guy for them, and he has been. Again, it's just, he's just not someone who ever gets those headlines. And, yeah, it's a cool nickname because he has been that, James. And, yeah, look, he knows where he's at in his career. He's had a bunch of injuries, some freakish, you know, some bad luck. But he is healthy, and he's definitely one of those guys who sort of rises to that occasion, if you will, in the playoffs.
He is Jim Ozarski, covers all things Milwaukee Bucks for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. If you're looking for the opposing viewpoints throughout the entirety of this series, running it inside the Bucks locker room, Jim is the place to go. You can follow him on Twitter at Jim Ozarski. Thank you again for making time for us. Looking forward to reading your coverage throughout, and hopefully at least from a neutral, if we step back to a neutral standpoint, this winds up being the thrilling series that it was in the in-season tournament.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to getting down to Indianapolis here in a few days, one of my favorite cities.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you, sir.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
Query & Company on a Monday. No Jake Query today. Well-deserved day off for him coming off the Long Beach Grand Prix.
I don't know about well-deserved. You know, he just got a day off, you know.
Hey, I mean, it ended up with you gracing us with your presence, so it's a win
for
all of us, I think.
That's the well part. The deserved part belongs to me as well, but no, I'm just joking.
That is the voice of James Boyd. Of course, Eddie Garrison here with us as well. And one of our favorites on the Pacers beat... He's going to get his name said correctly twice today, but I think just in the interest of consistency and thematicness of this show, Dustin
Dopierak
joins us today. Dustin, I know you're disappointed that you don't get that throughout the course of the interview today, but it felt like we'd be doing Jake a disservice not to continue that in his stead. How are things?
We're making a tradition now. I really like it. I'm entertained by this, but things are good. I apologize. I'm walking through Milwaukee as we speak, so you're about to hear some church bells that I'm walking by.
Yeah,
right,
I was going to say, are they still excited about Dame's 35 last night? Is it still carried over into the afternoon?
That's what they do, is every hour on the hour in Milwaukee, when Dame goes over 30, there are church bells that ring. And so, you know, there's a service just for Dame, and that's just how it goes up here.
A service for Dame? You need a service for the pay. They in there praying.
Yeah, they are. You're right. You're not wrong. It isn't very much
they're in the
come with the Lord moment trying to regather and regroup from last night. Speaking of which, going straight into that, this was one of the quotes of many from Tyrese Halliburton post-game. He said, "It's easy to just say we miss shots, and now we're nervous or whatever." Whatever you all are going to run with, of course, referring to Dustin Dopierak and the fine folks in the media, it doesn't matter. I just feel like we missed shots at the end of the day. The ball wasn't hopping, and they made shots in the first half, and that kind of dug us a hole. Aside from the little jab, and I get it, like that is the namesake of player and reporter relations throughout time, but especially in today's society. But aside from that little jab, I don't think necessarily he's wrong. I think that's the proper mindset you want, especially from your star player. Your thoughts on that and maybe other similar bites of sound that you gathered post-game from the Pacers after the loss?
Yeah, I mean, you could go a bunch of different ways with that. I mean, like, the way I was kind of approaching it was, part of the reason it looked like you guys couldn't shoot is it looked like you guys were nervous. I mean, like, I think, in a way, I was giving them a lifeline for saying that. They're like, you guys aren't an 8 of 39 shooting team. You're generally better than that. You know, again, a lot of the shots they got were really good shots, and that was kind of the problem, is they missed wide open threes. I mean, like, you wouldn't go so far as to say gimmies because no three is a gimme, but, like, you know, like, he had every reason to say, well, I like what we got. It's like, well, you should make some of those. You know, a few of those should go in. I mean, he only took three of them, but they're 8 of 39 from three, and I think that obviously led to a lot of bigger issues. It became harder to drive on them because I think the Bucks started just daring them to shoot threes. They were going to wall up on drives, and we trust at this point, after you've missed your 14, that you're not going to make a whole lot tonight, and we can do that and not really get burned. So, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, now it is the mindset that you probably want. It's like, oh, they just didn't go in, you know, it's a bad day or whatever. But, I mean, I think guys that had been there before were like, oh, this is what it looks like when a team isn't quite ready for this. It's their first time through the order, and they're figuring out, oh, this is what it's like. And Miles Turner was basically like, oh, like, we got punched in the mouth. Like, that's what it was. And I think, end of the day, that's the overall theme, is that these guys, they did come in and they found out what playoff basketball was like. And for as much as they were talking about it, as much as they were trying to prepare themselves, they weren't really prepared. It's not that they weren't prepared for the Bucks. They just weren't prepared for, the environment, for the intensity, for, the degree to which every possession matters. I mean, for all the time they spent emphasizing and speaking about that and whatever, it didn't show up. Once the lights came on and they were looking around and it was loud and Dame was going off for 35 in the first half.
Dustin
Dopierak.
He sounds like he's in a movie or some commercial. That's great. But I'll add that to your point about, you know, asking players, and I've been in the situation as well where it's a bad loss. I think my closest example to that would be when the Colts fell just short of the postseason this past January. You're going in the locker room and no one wants to talk to you anyway. You're trying to figure out what do you ask. A little different because the Pacers season is continuing. But two things you should tell Tyrese. You know, you're undefeated as a writer because you don't go out there and play. But in all seriousness, what is that nuance like, maybe for listeners out there, when you're trying to obviously recap what you just saw, but you're trying to glean some perspective from the players who were involved? Because ultimately, as much as we love to read your writing, it is powered and sort of shaped by the responses, not all the time, but sometimes you get from a locker room that obviously is kind of feeling the brunt of that playoff weight, that playoff loss.
Right. I mean, I think I you know, you obviously know this stuff. It's like you're constantly trying to sort of, you know, take everybody's temperature and figure out, like, all right, like, what are they going to go for and what are they not going to go for? And, like, sometimes you're really hedgy about what you're asking, and sometimes that works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you've got to come out and be blunt. You're figuring out each individual guy and saying, okay, where's this guy at right now? And oddly enough, I mean, like, Halliburton was – I've seen him – way worse in terms of, like, you know, I mean, like, you know, I've got video of it. Like, I've seen him way more upset. I don't want to talk to anybody. I'm not interested in playing around with any of your, you know, narratives today, sort of thing. I mean, this time it was seemingly more like, all right, that was game one. That was it. We're moving on. But he, you know, I had more opportunity to kind of take chances there, but he just wasn't knocked up before. But I've seen it worse. My apologies. Still windy.
Yeah, I was going to say, forecast currently in Milwaukee, 16 miles per hour with 64 partly cloudy skies, and we're feeling all 16 miles an hour there, clearly.
You sure are.
All I heard was that this is a Pacers opportunity to just open a window at the Milwaukee practice facility, get Dame off his game for game two. Maybe it'll blow Giannis over a little bit as well. Keep him out for game two. No, I'm joking.
I love this. let's stick with this trend. I'm entertained by this. But yeah, I mean, so more or less, I think it was just a case of, you know, they weren't trying to play into too much and they were just trying to move on. And I think, you know, they did enough in the second half to be like, all right, like, we have our feet set now. You know, like, that first half was a mess, but it was game one. It was the first time through, you know, like, maybe we're past that. We're past the jitters. That part's over. We can just be normal and play basketball again.
He covers the Pacers for the Indy Star. Dustin
Dopierak
is our guest. Always nice to have him along for the ride. Dustin, for the Pacers, how much of the pressure that is outside narratives roughly going into this series but is now a reality of missing an opportunity to steal a game on the road when a star player is absent? How much is that at this stage felt or magnified, knowing that Giannis probably won't go in game two, but he could be returning at some point in this series?
Yeah, I mean, I think the also part is that you still do have another chance. You know, I mean, I think they have to look at it as, okay, you missed an opportunity there. You're not going to go into Milwaukee and take both. I mean, I think you have that sort of glimmering hope of trying to
use that. Are there any coffee shops by chance you could duck into? Is there any wall you could stand up against?
Yeah, I'm going to get to this wall. I'm in particular in a wind tunnel where I'm standing, so I'm going to try to get to the nearest building and stay there for a second. I'm almost there. I've got another 10 feet. So it's going to calm down, I hope. I think that, you know, they know they lost an opportunity, but they have one more. And I think that might be a situation where it's like, okay, like, now you've got your feet set. Now you have a sense of what this is like. Now you realize it's just basketball. And so maybe then, all right, you've got another chance. You've got another opportunity. It wasn't the only one, you know, where it's like, obviously, if you came up, if this was game five and he was only be up for out for one game and you needed to get one on the road and you hadn't yet, then there's an additional level of pressure there. But I think just the fact that you have a second one and you can say, okay, let's settle into this thing. Let's feel like this is normal. It's just basketball. We played this all the time. We've beat these guys before. You know, let's not make it too big for ourselves. I mean, I think that gives them a scenario where they can turn it down a little bit and they can look at a few things that went right in the second half and say, see, we can do this. We can play this game. We've done it before. And, you know, they can kind of play off that and reduce a little bit of that pressure.
Unless you have a side gig as an airbender, it appears that you have found the wall, so we are good now, successfully.
Yes.
Dustin
Dopierak
is our guest. Dustin, one thing that bugged me the most last night, which was going into the fourth, despite everything that happened, they cut it to 12. And it's like, all right, this is modern NBA. That's basically 4 points 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. No problem. They didn't get right back into this ball game. And I tweeted this at the time, and I mentioned at the start of the show. I asked for, man, we got everything going on in Milwaukee. We got Star Wars level engines just driving by. I asked for, going into the fourth, Miles Turner, Pascal Siakam, Tyrese Halliburton. What I got instead was Doug McDermott in meaningful playoff basketball. I get it. This team has relied on the bench heavily during the regular season. So it's kind of a two-part question. At what point does tightening of the rotation have to happen? Like, do we need a larger sample size to know, yeah, things need to tighten up? And have we reached a point where I get why they acquired McDermott, but he's maybe unplayable and shouldn't see the floor unless it's garbage time?
The only reason that I maintain the idea that maybe you have to play McDermott is that he has the most career threes of anybody on the roster. And there was at least a couple occasions toward the end of the year where I saw him take and make a shot that I didn't see anybody else currently on the roster that could take, that I said, you know who used to be able to make those shots? They don't have anymore. Buddy Hield.
Sure.
So there were a couple of those moments that make me say, you got to not forget he's there. That just maybe there might be a time where he makes sense.
Let me slightly rephrase that then, because I don't mean to cut across you, because I get that standpoint of it. But I guess what I was more looking for is, it feels like there's a moment where, regardless if you're trying to match minutes with Dame or if you're trying to match minutes with Chris Middleton, at some point, especially in a game like that, if you're down 12 and you have one last run to go at it, I would rather see the stars out there. And then if you fall behind like you did without them, where it's 25, then okay, if you want to pull the plug, I get it. But I'd rather give them that bite at the apple to open the fourth.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I don't think you're wrong there. I think it's obviously a question of, all right, like, what were you sensing in terms of, you know, like, rest and making sure, and like, you obviously don't want to burn them all out in game one, but obviously you have to look at this is the stretch run, and you're supposed to, you know, ask a little bit more from your stars than you do, you know, during the regular season. Like, you're getting down to it. You don't know how much longer you're going to be playing, so you can't act as if they've got another month and a half to play. I mean, you have to make sure that happens, and so you got to make sure those guys are on the floor. And so, you know, I think it was a fair critique to say, you know, he went too far with the bench as a whole yesterday. I mean, he ended up playing, what, six bench guys. I mean, obviously, some of that was because they didn't feel like Jalen Smith was playing well enough. He gave Isaiah Jackson some minutes. I mean, like, he obviously wasn't thrilled about what was out there. But, you know, I understand feeling like, okay, like, if you want to run up and down the floor, the only way to do that is to dig into your bench a little bit and, you know, be able to have some fresh legs out there. But on the flip side, yeah, you are having some minutes where you don't have Pascal and you don't have Halliburton and you don't have Miles. And so it's a question of, all right, when is that really burning you? So, no, I mean, I think obviously Rick has to ask himself the questions as to how far he needs to push this. Obviously, the bench was the best in the league this year as far as scoring, but again, the playoffs are different, and that changes things. So he does, I think, have to be constantly asking himself how far, you know, how much he should be asking from his bench, when he needs to tighten up, when it's time, when the guys have proven that they can't be out there for certain matchups or against certain teams, and then adjust from there. So, I mean, it's a big question, I think, for him going forward in terms of, like, how he's going to handle that. McDermott in particular, again, like, I feel like, again, there might be an opportunity where it makes sense for him, and you know, you want to see him make a couple shots and then see if he can ride that, because you don't have a great other off the ball, you know, true off the ball shooting option, maybe, you know, other than Tyrese, I guess. And you know, but all the same, if you can't defend anybody, then, you know, like, then at times you really can't play him if he's out there and Chris Middleton's cutting them up, you know, like, that's a loss. So, you know, it's a question that needs to be asked. I don't know if you could definitely say McDermott can't play anymore at all. But he certainly didn't, you know, earn any more minutes last night.
Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
I'm scared to say his name because he's going to do the thing. But Dustin, I do want to ask, when you look at this team and how they've sort of been built, obviously they're extremely young. What was Miles Turner's reaction to the game, and maybe where does that veteran leadership sort of come in at this point in the season? Because sometimes I forget that he is their longest tenure player. He's an older player in the sense of, like, he is a true veteran. He's been around the league more than half a decade at this point. So how can he maybe lift this group up? Maybe not lift them up is the right, you know, phrase, but just keep them, you know, focused on the fact that it is a series and to ultimately, like, end this sort of losing streak that they've had throughout the playoffs, which unfortunately Miles Turner has been a part of.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, I think he said the things in postgame that I think you'd want to hear from a veteran to us. And so, I mean, obviously the question is to what extent and how effective is that message getting through, you know, in game, you know, why, what, basically I think everybody has to own the fact that they weren't, you know, veteran guys that have been around, even a guy like Pascal who's won a title, Rick himself, weren't able to kind of stem that tide in the first half. So everybody's got to own that. So going forward, what else I say after this, you know, keeping that in mind, you know, basically I think he certainly identified by saying, look, like we got punched in the mouth. Like this was, we got jumped into the playoffs. We found out this is what it's like. And you know, we got knocked off just our perch there a lot. It was just a case of like, whoa, this is what it's like, man. We thought we were ready. We're really not. And I think he basically was sort of on one hand saying like, yes, like this really is amped up and you have to understand the difference. But also, okay, you know, you got through that, you took that punch, we figured out early, right out of the gate, that this is different basketball, and so, you know, that's out of your system, you're okay now. We're set in this, and we can go from there. So as far as that was concerned, I mean, I'm sure that's the message you got across in the locker room, and I think just getting that to everybody of like, all right, yeah, this is what it is. This is what it feels like. Do we all get it now? Do we all understand? Okay, can we now just play basketball? You know, I think that's. I'm sure the message he's getting across, and that should, I think, settle them down to a degree. But you know, I think any leader in that position had to be better at that moment in, like, looking around and seeing, you know, the look there in the headlights, look and saying, we've got to stop this right now, and find a way to turn it around before it got out of hand.
Do you feel like the only option for the Pacers to really flex muscles, to turn the tables, as to borrow a phrase from Damian Lillard, as he mentioned in the lead up to this series, to turn the tables back on Milwaukee, is for Tyrese Halliburton to be more selfish?
That's definitely a piece to it. I mean, that's for sure. I mean, and obviously, you know, for him to be more selfish, there does a lot of other things do have to happen. I mean, I think, you know, when you're trying to drive on three and four guys because they're in your way, I mean, there's a point where selfish becomes too selfish. And especially, you know, I think one issue with Halliburton at the end of the day, like as good of a player as he is, you know, it is hard for him to will his way to buckets sometimes because he's not the biggest and the strongest guy. And that is something that I think he's going to find out over the course of this playoffs, how much that matters and the degree to which he's got to do some physical transformation and really kind of, you know, get in the weight room and add some muscle so that he can get in and sort of bounce off some bodies when they're in his way. And I think that's a little bit harder for him. But, I mean, he's got to hunt more than seven shots. You know, I mean, I understand where Rick Carlisle is coming from and saying, you know, it's more about him as a creator. Let's not get too up in this conversation about how many shots Tyrese makes, but on the flip side, it's like, yeah, you're doing that because you don't want to see the narrative out there. Like, I get why you don't want me to write this, but, like, you know, the guy averages 20 a game for you for the year. Like, getting 9 on 7 shots isn't enough. Like, you've got to get more production from your all-star, and he's also, again, probably your best outside shooter at the end of the day, and if he's only taking 3 threes over the course of the game, and you're taking 39 as a team, I mean, like, that's not enough percentage for your best guy to be taking those shots. So, like, again, like, I get in a lot of cases he's probably making the right play and hitting the open man, and that's what he's supposed to do, but there's got to be some opportunities where he hunts shots. I mean, he doesn't have to take 25, but he's got to take more than 7.
Last one from me. Do you think that this is an instance where they miss Benedict Mathurin a little bit just because of the shot creation and the ability to make something out of nothing, or maybe make a defense pay when they close out too hard, something like that?
and the hell-bent desire that I'm going to the rim no matter how many people were in front of me, yes, I think they missed that for sure. I mean, like, Ben, you know, Ben's level of confidence is off the charts. You can't knock it off. He's not going to change. Like, it doesn't matter if there's five bodies in there. Like, when he wants to go, he's going to go. And there are sometimes when you're like, you know, that takes you out of your game, but sometimes you're like, that's exactly what you need. You need somebody that is afraid of absolutely nothing. And, yeah, I mean, like, they could have really used Benedict Mathurin out there being not scared of the moment one single bit, because he wouldn't have been. You know, he absolutely would have been willing to take every shot, you know, like, not care if he missed, take the next one, you know, drive two and three bodies to get to the rim, finish through contact. You know, he can do those things. And, I mean, maybe he would have had a rough night where he went 5 for 20 or whatever. But, you know, I think he would have looked around and saw everybody else was a little bit shaky and said, well, heck with that, I'm not. You know, I'm going to the rim, I'm going to make a play. And so, yeah, I mean, I think they definitely missed that. And it's, you know, a shame for him, for as much as, you know, this playoff series at the end of the day is going to be about experience for these guys and getting used to it. It really would have been nice for them to have a young, you know, up-and-coming player like Mathurin and get the sense of this, what it's like, and actually be on the floor for it.
Dustin Dupirak is our guest, covers all things Pacers for the Indy Star. Dustin, the second half, and I know it was somewhat out of reach, but the second half, Damian Lillard is held, you know, relatively in check. There's not anything in terms of his impact or his fingerprints really on the game in the second half. Chris Middleton certainly did. Bobby Portis did. There's other areas where that occurred. But how much of the assignment moving forward do you think is defensively them being willing to send doubles and them basically saying, okay, anybody else but Dame beat us like they did in the second half to open the game versus, no, there's still enough trust, say, in Andrew Nembhard to draw that assignment and hold things?
Yeah, it's a good question to figure out what direction they're going to go with that. Is that there? I mean, I think, you know, Nembhard was trying to be aggressive and he got himself in some bad positions. And I think he got himself really amped up for that assignment. And Lillard was like, I know how to play you, basically. Like, you know, like, you're 24. I've been in this league for a really long time. And I know what it's like when guys come at me like this. I know how to get you in bad positions. So, you know, I think it's reading the scenario is like, again, is Dame going to be like this for, you know, the entire series? And if he is, then you've got to throw doubles at him. It's just, again, like, you know, I mean, he didn't go crazy on them during the regular season. You know, like, there was, I think, maybe one game where he really got them. But there were some others where he was really quiet, and Nembhard had something to do with that. So, you know, I think you got to read it. You know, maybe you start him out just in playing him straight, and then, you know, see if Dame is on one and try to figure that out early, and then throw doubles, you know, and be ready to do it as soon as you know. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a big part of it is deciding what that's where you're going to go. And, you know, especially if Giannis it isn't going to play game two, you know, maybe you got to go all out on that and believe that that's your best opportunity.
Did Ben Shepherd look like a rookie yesterday?
Yeah. Yeah, no, he did. I mean, I think, I'd have to rewatch and see if like there's any moments that he looked like he grew up a little bit. But yeah, no, I mean, he looked like a rookie, and Nembhard and Halliburton looked like they were playing in the first playoffs. And a bunch of other guys looked like they hadn't played in playoffs in really meaningful scenarios. And the guy who, again, it was pretty obvious the guy who'd been to a finals before, you know, I mean, like Pascal Siakam, you know, his heartbeat did not quicken one bit. Everybody else's did.
Do they have enough pieces, the Pacers, to offset that for it to be a real wake up call and it kind of having to be a baptism by fire for the rookies or for players that just have not been at this stage before?
I mean, they do if things come together. I mean, part of it is just shots got to go down. If you start making threes, it changes the game. You know, and they had open ones, and if you start making the open ones and everybody gets, the defense gets scrambled again, and then you can drive on that, you know, then you have a chance. I mean, they have enough guys who can make shots, but it's got to, like, you know, basically confidence has to transfer. You got to start believing that, like, you know, the rim is just as far away in April as it was in January, and you got to believe that. And so at some point, you know, that's got to be the thing. Is that there's got to be just that same level of confidence, less nerves, and just play like they know how to play.
I have four people that watch this game, which is probably, well, Chapel probably did as well. Mike Chapel did, but since the one that covers it and those that watched it, just for the poll to make sure I'm not insane, end of the first quarter, when Damian Lillard crosses half court, We all knew that's how that was going to end, right? Step back, crossover three at the horn.
Sure.
Like no one was surprised by that, right? So make sure that you're on record with that with me.
Yeah, no one was surprised by that. But in the same way, if you try to step to that point, the last thing you need is that to become a 4-point play.
So, I mean, like, look, this
and it could have.
You're right.
If someone would have overplayed that, it could have been a 4-point play.
You're right. This is why I'm not in the X's and O's game per se, but like, I almost would have just tried to steal off, and damn, if you'd like the layup, then Miles is their help side, or Pascal's their help side, but we're not letting you get a three. But yes, you're right.
Yeah.
If you do play it two over, you know what? It was momentum anyway. It's semantics.
Yeah.
It's semantics, Dustin. I don't care if it's a 4-point play or a 3-point play. Don't let it get off. That's all I'm saying.
Right. Yeah.
Enjoy game two. We'll keep following along, find all your work on the Indy Star. Any selective pieces or any key pieces that you're currently working on that we need to dive into outside of the regular beat?
Nothing I'm working on. If you haven't read the McConnell piece yet, I felt pretty decent about that one. So that came out this week. If you want to read more about TJ and his season, obviously he didn't have the best night. Nobody had the best night last night, but that's when we're checking out. And there'll be plenty more coming out, heading my way to practice now, and then from Milwaukee now, and then we'll have Pacers practice after that. So we'll have a whole bunch of stuff. Also, tell my guy Nubias I said hi when he's on later.
We'll do that for certain.
We'll do.
Dustin, enjoy Milwaukee, and please continue to hit all the spots that Jake tossed along to you. If you're not having some past blue ribbon by the time you come home, I think he's going to be pretty disappointed. So
he really will be.
Thanks, guys. Dustin.
I'll see you.
That is Dustin. All right. He wasn't there for me. My guy was there for me. Let me down. That was Dustin Dopierak. I know how to say it.
So I'm good.
There we go. Thank you very much. Of the Indy Star.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
3 days away from the 2024 NFL Draft, we already have one member of the press corps that will cover things on Thursday through the weekend, and we add another now. He is the Dean, Mike Chappell, of Fox 59 and CBS4. We were robbed of one thing from him for most of the weekend, no fault of his own, but if you follow him on Twitter at mchappell51, no clapping raccoon gif throughout the weekend, unfortunately, or at least not as many as I'm used to seeing. Chap, it was a little long nap, not quite hibernation, but a little bit of a nap for the raccoon gif.
Well, you know, I tried to find one of a skunk with its button year or something. I thought, no, it was a bad game. We'll give them a mulligan. Now, if they do it again next time, then we're looking for a really good skunk picture to put out there.
I support it. I feel like at that point, all bets are off and drastic measures need to be taken. Chap, we stress this all the time, but it's part of the reason why we love having you on, because the knowledge, expertise, and the amount of time that you spent as a longest tenured beat writer for the Colts, which is why I feel comfortable leading off with this. Your colleague, Stephen Older, who we had on, or who we'll have on tomorrow, had a piece come out about an hour or so ago, update on Jim Irsay's status, saying that he won't be in the draft room amid recovery. From my standpoint, Chap, it was good at least to see both from that story, and then I think your story last month of phone conversations with him, of him progressing the right way. But from your seat, what this means on his road to recovery and the prognostication, you know, with the franchise moving forward with Jim Irsay?
Well, that he's on the road to recovery. Because there's just been questions. And when you have such a visible owner as Irsay has been, kind of go, you know, dark for a while. And then, you know, when things come out about the December 8th incident in Carmel and other things, you worry. And you hear things, you know, like a lot of media areas, we at CBS4 and Fox 59, we heard things that we didn't print or publish because you can't verify it. But I was concerned, very concerned. I consider Jim a good friend. I do. We've been dealing since 84 when they moved here. And it's sometimes been difficult balancing friendship with the fact that I cover the team as well, but you make it work. So finally, when I talked to him in early March, it's just good to hear the voice. It just is. It moves the needle. I was going to say it does move. It moves the needle because you hear a name, and he was still in the hospital at the time. I'm guessing he's out now, but it's just good to hear. And the fact that, you know, Steven talked to him over the weekend, it's just good that he's reaching out to some of us. And the fact that he's not in the draft room, you know, I tell you, if Jim Irsay is sitting there in his home Thursday night and he wants them to do something, they're going to do something. I mean, you can make your opinions known virtually, but I think for the most part, he's allowed Chris Ballard and the coaching staff and the personnel people to do their job. He told me a long time ago that when you're an owner, the important thing is to put the right people in place and let them do their jobs unless they're threatening the horseshoe brand. So he'll monitor it. He'll have input, but this will still be a Chris Ballard-driven process.
Do you think it's good? And I'm not trying to say this like he's a delicate creature that we need to, like, you know, talk with kid gloves on. But I think of any time I've had a relative or somebody that's been going through something from whatever the rehabilitation may be. In this case for him, a large part of it is, of course, the surgery he just had. Do you think it's good to have a goal to build towards, like the induction of Dwight Freeney on August 3rd?
Sure. I'm sure that when he kind of started the rehab, he was thinking, boy, the draft. Although, again, you can do the draft stuff off-site. You can. You can't do the Hall of Fame off-site. You know, it's in Canton, and he needs to be on the stage when they pull the cover off Freeney's bronze bust. So, yeah, of course it does. It just, you know, you want to have something to push for. And initially to him, it's to be back to where he can run the team and interact with people and be out there and, you know, with his daughters and the grandkids. But as far as, yeah, that is, it's important to him. This is the third player to have Jim Irsay, selected Jim Irsay to be the guy to present him. That's a pretty big deal. You know, it's always been someone that's very influential in that player's life. You know, Peyton had Archie. So it's, yes, I think it's very important to have a goal to reach. And that's one that he really needs to be able to kind of be mobile-ish, because you got to be up on the stage. And I think it's so important to him. So on two levels, one is to get back and be able to carry out his life duties. But then second, to be there with Freeney. Because at the time, you're going to have Peyton there, you're going to have Marvin there and Edgerrin there, and all the other former Colts will be there. So it's really, really important to him.
So, Mike, I know, obviously, like you said, this means a lot to Irsay and the opportunity to not be in the draft room. You know, he's one of those guys who's super hands-on, but he'll be okay with that. But looking specifically at the draft, what was your reaction to Chris Ballard's comments Friday where he said, you know, these cornerbacks that you all are basically banging the gavel about are proven or they've grown up in a sense and they're not as young as you think they are. They're not as inexperienced as you think they are. Does that maybe sway your thinking of what he could do in the first round of this draft?
No, because he also said, like at the combine, how that it was a pretty good tight end room. He liked the tight end room, and they got a lot of bodies and a lot of potential guys. You say, well, maybe, but because cornerback, James, what he said too is, he said you're all whipping the ass of the offensive line a couple of years ago. Yeah, because they weren't very good, you know.
Right.
And then he said, well, but they got better. They got better, which they did. They did. You know, they threw Bernie Ryman out there, totally unprepared. You know, at Denver, and he struggled, and then got better. And then last year we saw him get a lot better. I understand what he's saying. I still, Juju Brents is kind of like Anthony Richardson, kind of.
Yeah.
I mean, all the time he missed, I mean, he played more, but, and then Jalen Jones, I thought he played better at the end. Kenny Moore, you know, he's going to play well, but I still think they need a starting corner. You know, is that going to be with the 15th pick? Is that going to be in the second round? I don't know, but I think he believes that because he has to believe that. But then if he drafts a corner at 15, then was he just kind of blowing smoke at us? I don't know. I think a lot of that's what GMs have to say, because he also talked up the receiver room with Pittman, Pierce, and Downs, and I think Joel Erickson mentioned, well, you only played three guys last year. You know, is that and they said, well, that's, you know, that's normally how it is. Well, not normally. You like to have a fourth guy. So I think that's kind of coach speak, GM speak that we get this time of year. But I will be shocked if the first pick isn't a wide receiver or corner and the second round pick isn't whatever you didn't get in round one, just because that's what this roster needs.
I completely agree. I'll add, Mike, that there is some sort of there is something to be said about the 2022 season when he brought it up. I was thinking to myself, maybe this is me being a jerk. There was a lot going on that season, so I'm sorry I didn't recognize that the offensive line had made the strides that you saw.
So, yeah, that game in Minnesota kind of made me forget about any kind of position.
Exactly. So it's like you're trying to be professional. Obviously, I did see some things as well, but that was not number one on my priority list at all. As far as maybe some sleeper needs in this draft, where do you see that being? I know we talked a lot about the cornerback room, but could you see them leaning towards a safety on day three or day two or early on day three, or running back early on day three? Like, where do you see some of the other maybe peripheral holes in this roster?
I still think they should sign a veteran safety. There are really good guys out there you're going to get for on the cheap, so to speak, at this time of the year and in the offseason. The big money has really been spent on people. So I think you can get a really good corner in free agency. I think they draft running back, yes, and I think they draft an offensive tackle, not high. Because remember, he talked. He said this is a great draft for offensive line, mm-hmm. and you're going to get some guys. I think he said mid rounds and even later. I think you're always looking at tackles. I thought Blake Freeland played really well last year. They sort of treated him like Ryman, where they just kind of threw him out there and said, swim. Braden Smith, I'm not moving past Braden Smith, but his contract's up next year, I believe it is.
Yes.
So you've always got to play in a year or two ahead, and you cannot leave yourself short of linemen. Ryan Kelly, he's up this year, after this year. Is the next center on your roster? I probably not. So I think, and with seven picks, I understand how he likes to trade back to get more picks, and what do you say, the more picks, the more chance to hit on guys. I understand that. But this is such a young roster, and Stephen Holder mentioned this. If you look at the roster, this is a very young roster. Most of their draft picks from the last 2 years are on the roster, which is like 20-some guys, 18 guys. And at some point, how many young players are too many young players that you can get meaningful snaps and develop? So, I wouldn't mind adding two or three players that are going to be players, that these guys in 4 years are still going to be here. They're going to be players. Certainly the first and second round pick should be really solid players. I just don't know the value of having another seventh or sixth and hoping they turn into Zaire Franklin, which would be kind of cool. But that just doesn't happen that often. I think this roster is at the point that maybe you've got enough young developmental players. We got two or three draft picks from last year that didn't play because of IR from injuries. Hall and who was a tackle, Jake Witt, and Daniel Scott is safety. So they've got a lot of young players to develop. That's why I still think they need a veteran safety, even with Blackman coming back. Offensive line, running back, yes. I think, boy, history is showing you can find those guys that are pretty doggone good later in the draft. So those are areas that we should look at. Tight end, not so much unless it's Brock Bowers. And would you rather have Brock Bowers or Malik Nabers? I'd probably take Nabers, a deep threat, but they've got to help Anthony Richardson. They just do. I was talking to Rick Venturi, and I would err on the side of giving my young quarterback so many options. Bill Polian did that with Peyton Manning. Every year, it was another skill player, So I'm not that sold on the receiver room to this point. So adding an elite receiver with deep threat really kind of intrigued me.
The Dean Mike Chappell of Fox 29 and CBS 4 is our guest. Chap, two things, and a real quick one on the, I know you just threw out a name, but on the neighbors aspect of things, if we're talking about that, in all likelihood, we're talking about them needing to move up to get him, right?
You're not going where you're going to go, are you?
Right. No, I mean, I don't think he'll be there at 15. I think he'd have to.
Oh, I'm going there, Mike.
I'm talking Marv Jr.
Oh, yes, I'm going there.
No. I'm willing to go there, but that's not what I meant. I just meant you reference neighbors. Like, if you would rather have neighbors or Bowers, that would be, like, the only way neighbors are going to be there for them would be if they moved up, correct?
Oh, move. Yes, yes.
Okay.
And how much would they move up? I don't know. The idea of moving up to get Marv Jr., it would probably start with your next year's first-round pick.
Correct.
And something else. A couple of these guys have got mock drafts where they've got the Colts trading up to 9 with the Bears, which wouldn't be nearly as expensive. That's why I say I really don't care if they have 7 or 8 picks this year. I would rather have 5 and get a really, really good player in the first round. Because, again, I think it's a young enough roster that you don't need more developmental players. This league's all about elite players, difference-making players, and I think they got a good roster. But who are their difference-makers on this team? They've got Richardson. They've got Jonathan Taylor and DeForest Buckner. And
Michael Pittman Jr. is probably right there, right?
I know I'm leaving Pittman out, but is he the kind of guy, as good as he's been, is he the kind of guy that you worry about during the week? Boy, we've got to shut down this guy.
Sure.
I don't think so. Now, the other guys, yes. That's why I say they need more people that really move the needle.
Well, to that end, Chap, and the reason I asked just for the clarifier on neighbors, let's just say for the sake of argument, and I don't think this guy is going to be there, to be clear. I've said that a couple times today. I just don't. But if Brock Bowers is there and you go tight end at 15, you don't have to trade up to do it. You just go tight end. You feel like you have a set it and forget it tight end that, I'm not saying he's going to be all pro out of the gate, but you're confident Shane Steichen get the most out of him, and maybe you hope if Flores is a Dallas Goedert at some point in time in terms of what he could do for an offense. Chris Ballard seems to think that high-level belief, high-level confidence in this roster, whether he's posturing, whether he's just saying what general managers are supposed to say because they're not going to trash their own players. Okay, I get all that. Throw it to the side. I'm with you. This should all be about Anthony Richardson and his development. Do you look at their roster and say they are good enough to go tight end at 15 and then with their first selection in the second round go wide receiver?
Yeah, and then you still have an addressed cornerback.
Right, I know. That's the sacrifice,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I guess. If it's Bowers at 15, which I don't think it will.
I don't either.
He won't be there.
Yeah.
But you probably won't have the top 3 receivers will be gone. So then you're weighing Bowers against the 4th receiver, whomever, Brian Thomas. Boy, he's pretty good. He's pretty good. God, I might even take Brian Thomas over Brock Bowers. Although I know, again, I lived through the Dallas Clark era, and I'm telling you, you talk difference makers, what that tight end can do that can get down the field, it just opens doors for you. And the idea that Shane Steichen give him a tight end like that, holy smokes. But then give him a deep threat receiver. And one thing that we've talked about in the press room with James and everybody else is what do they believe they have with Alec Pierce? Has he not emerged because the offense and the quarterbacks have kept him down? Or is he just not the guy that they need him to be? That's a big decision to make. If you think that Pierce is going to be that guy, then maybe you don't put quite that much emphasis on we need a deep threat, because in their mind, well, we've already got one. Well, we've not seen it to this point. So
yeah, I'm in the latter camp, Chap. I think it's more of a shield to say that it's just because of the quarterback play that's there. Like, I feel like I've seen enough.
I tend to agree, but then, gosh, I was talking to Reggie Wayne, and he said, God, there was 10 or 11 plays last year where Pierce is running all by himself, and they either couldn't or wouldn't get the ball to him. So what does the narrative on Alec Pierce look like if he catches 5 or 6 balls for 40 yards and all of a sudden, hey, he's pretty good. But without those, he's not. So that's why it's really incumbent on these coaches to kind of this is what we had, this is what we didn't do because of who we had, and this is what we can do. They're putting so much, James and I have talked, they're putting so much on Anthony Richardson being that guy.
Yep.
And lifting everybody around him, which is what great quarterbacks do, but this quarterback's played four games.
Mike, I was going to ask you about that. So we have seen some different movement throughout the AFC South. Obviously, the Houston Texans are all in on C.J. Stroud. They should be. He looked like a star last year, top 10 quarterback, all of the above. But then you look at, you know, the Titans. They're in a similar situation with a young quarterback trying to figure out, is he the guy? I think, obviously, the Colts are higher on him than the Titans are on Will Levis. However, we saw the Titans make some moves to surround Levis with more talent to sort of evaluate who he is. All that to say this, Mike, do you think the Colts are being too cautious with trying to maybe supercharge this team, or is it a fair step to take because he's only played four games? Because my argument is that I can see it from both sides, but the argument for maybe trying to go out there and get more talent right now today, spending some, a little bit more money, is that you know absolutely for sure what you have, assuming Anthony's healthy, after this season. Whereas if you don't get, you know, enough talent, or you were maybe too cautious, you may have, you know, may fall a few plays short like you did last year. So where do you kind of stand on just the overall conservative approach of them and them saying, oh, we're not trying to, you know, crown him yet. But I mean, what else are you doing if the only change you made was him being healthy?
Yeah, I agree. You know, let's not make him Superman yet. But that's what you're doing. You're expecting him to rise everyone else up. And again, I always, whenever I write that, I always mention that goes hand in hand with Jonathan Taylor. He played basically seven, eight games when he was actually himself. Everything else was contract or ankle or whatever it was. So they really believe with those two guys back, it's going to make a huge difference. And then also, I wish they'd been more active in free agency, but it was one of those weird years where they had, gosh, five or six players of their own that they really valued that they had to take care of, or that they chose to take care of. And that limited what they could do on the market. Although, you know, they made a strong push for Daniel Hunter. Does that tell you that that tells me that they're not totally happy with their pass rush, that they wanted to go out and get a stud guy. So, yeah, I don't know. And again, this isn't done yet. Maybe they'll still bring in a veteran receiver. I don't know, which would be out of character for them. But it's just kind of strange. Again, they seem to approach it like Richardson's a real deal. He's going to be back. He's going to stay on the field. Jonathan Taylor's going to approach 2021 Jonathan Taylor. Michael Pittman's going to add a deep threat to his game because now we can get the ball down the field and Josh Downs and this, that, and the other. I understand all that. But what if the quarterback either, heaven forbid, isn't the guy, or he has another injury, and then where are you? I realize you got Joe Flacco. I realize that, but he's going to be limited in what he can do for you. So yeah, it's just strange. This is going to be so fascinating that it either works or it doesn't. You know, another nine and eight season. What's that going to prove? What's that going to get you? So they're banking on the quarterback and Jonathan Taylor really being good this year.
Chap, where do you envision their belief in the second round if they're looking at wide receivers? Like, doesn't have to be that first pick, but in day two selections, because you're right, the idea of a deep threat or a real cream of the crop difference maker probably stops Brian Thomas Jr. That's probably like where the
Xavier
real line
Worthy,
is. Yeah, Xavier Worthy's a speedster. We saw what he did with the combine times, but of course, like, he was projected anyway before that. Low first, mid second. Right. Do you think that they still have enough internal favor on their boards to say, well, even if we go defense, or if they pull a James Boyd mock draft owed to Chris Ballard and they trade back, do you think they still have enough grades in day two where they could find help for Anthony Richardson at wideout?
Well, you mean if they don't go that way in a round
Correct.
One?
If they don't do it at one, whether trading back or whether that's by taking a corner.
I think they would almost need to force themselves to take a receiver in round two. And again, you can probably get you a pretty good guy in round two, but you're not going to get you the same quality of guy that you could have gotten in round one. You know, maybe at where are they in round two? 46. Maybe that's where they do the Jonathan Taylor thing and they trade up whatever that was. Was it three or four spots to get JT in round two?
For context for our listeners, Chap, and I know these don't matter, and I hope I'm not revealing too much here, so if I am, then the cat's out of the bag, and James, I'll take you out to lunch or something as an apology. James is working on a mock draft right now with The Athletic, and he selected, okay, I won't say who he selected, but let's just say he went defensive. And as he's about to get with me, because I'm giving too much out of the bag here for a story it's going to break. But he went defensive, and it was a player where I'm like, you know what? That's fine. That's cool. That works. And then go get a wideout later. Do you feel like there is still, though, too much? Is it narrative or is it truth that they need to be speeding up Anthony Richardson's development by going wideout or going tight end at one? Because I'm with you, Chap. I look at what this year could be. And even if they're right about him being able to be an elite-level quarterback, if you don't have the right weapons around him, it's not going to matter.
I would err on the side of getting a stud receiver. I just would. I would rather have a stud receiver at 15. You're going to get a guy that if he doesn't make it, then everybody else would have missed on him too. He's going to be that kind of a player. I'd rather get that different maker at 15 and a, well, I hate to say second tier, but a lesser corner. I just would. I would, as opposed to the other way around. I just maybe that means you need to score 30 points a game. I don't know. I just go back to the way Polian treated it, and you kept thinking, you got another receiver, really? I mean, Reggie Wayne at, what was he, 30 or 31? And you already had Marvin, you know, but that's the way, you know, and Anthony Gonzalez and they get Joe Adai and with Edger, and of course Edger has been gone. But I just think that, you know, Dallas Clark, I just think of don't let a lack of options and really good skill players, don't let that be the reason the quarterback faltered. When he really got going, Peyton made really middle-of-the-road receivers look pretty damn good. I don't want to discount Brandon Stokley. But Peyton made him really look good because, in part, because of the other people around him. When you've got Marvin and Reggie outside, then Brandon Stokley's a luxury inside. So I would err on the side of having too many, if you can have too many quality offensive players. They need a guy. I look at that room and I think Pierce has a chance, but. Are you willing to risk another year of your quarterback on finding out? So I would err on the side of giving an offensive player, and I still think to go defense, but I hope they go offense. That's just how I'm wired. And the Peyton Manning years have totally ruined me from a personnel standpoint. I admit it. So I saw what T.Y. did. I saw what T.Y. and Reggie did with Andrew Luck. Remember that year was it? Yeah. It was Luck and it was Fleener and Dwayne Allen and T.Y. Hilton and I believe Vic Ballard, and you know, give the quarterback every chance. And obviously they're planning on the offensive line having another great year. And I thought the offensive line played great last year. So give the quarterback a chance and don't be sitting there in January saying, man. Yeah. Wish we'd have done something better on offense, and that's on us. That can't be what they say in January.
He is the Dean, Mike Chappell of Fox 9 and CBS 4. And Chap, yes or no on this one? Any truth to the rumors? You're putting all the paper through a shredder, and you're going all digital for this year's draft. James was telling me he thought he saw you making the transition over to a tech-heavy draft. Is that true?
I have kept staples in business with ink and printer. I print things out because I like hard copy stuff. Digital, I make do, but I'm still a hard copy guy.
That's the best. I respect the heck out of that, and he's right. That is why you're the best. Looking forward to reading your coverage all week long, and looking forward to catching back up after the draft next Monday.
See you after Thursday, James. Be well.
Sounds good.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Still here rocking out in the drivehubler.com studio. I'm James Boyd alongside Aird Garrison on the ones and twos and Jimmy Cook, my co-host for the day because I'm filling in for Jake Query, who, you know, is too lazy to get out of bed after getting off a flight from Long Beach. No, I'm joking. Happy to fill in on this fine Monday afternoon. We have Nubias Wilborn on the line. He covers the Titans for alltitans.com/Sports Illustrated. Nubias, my brother, how you doing?
Man, blessed and highly favored. Man, happy to be on with you, my brother.
Sounds good. So we'll start. I just actually mentioned Will Levis in a different segment. What do you think of the talent they've added around him this offseason to sort of see, is he the guy in Tennessee also? And then also just looking at just the overall landscape of the AFC South, what are the Titans trying to do to kind of regain some ground?
Well, I mean, hey, man, this is what it is. I think now if you look at the NFL today, teams have clearly decided that if you're going to try to win a Super Bowl, do it while the quarterback's on a rookie deal, right? And Will Levis on the second year. He played 9 games, so up and down results. They got Kevin Ridley. They got Tony Pollard, who's a solid running back because they're trying to move away from what they were doing with the legend, Derrick Henry. All those years with him, you know, 3 yards in a cloud of dust, that whole thing, they're trying to move away, trying to modernize the offense. So they're going to go with Pollard at running back with a combination there. We'll see how that goes. That'll be interesting. As well as you look at, they got Lloyd Cushenberry. We'll see what they do in the draft. But what they have decided is, hey, man, we're going to go with Pollard and Tajay Spears at running back. We now got Ridley and DeAndre Hopkins at receiver. We'll see if Treylon Burks can finally step up and be good. Can they add that tight end? But they're pushing the chips in to see what they have in Will Levis. This year right here with Brian Callahan, who's considered as a quarterback whisperer, they're basically saying, hey, man, Will, there's no excuse. You either are or you aren't. And they're going to find out very quickly what Will Levis is as a quarterback. If he's that guy, we'll find out pretty quickly. If he's not, they got to find out, so they got to figure out to move on. Because now these teams do not stay on quarterbacks very long. If you don't believe me, go ask love Justin Fields up there in Chicago, now who's now in Pittsburgh. They move on quickly from quarterbacks. So basically, this is a make or break year for Will Levis, and that's what this year is about. Also mentioned the AFC South. I mean, hey, they ain't no secret what they're doing over there. You know, you look at the Houston Texans with C.J. Stroud, right? I mean, my God, look at the rookie year he had. I mean, one of the best rookie years we've seen. Anthony Richardson showed flashes before he got injured. And, I mean, Trevor Lawrence is still down in Jacksonville. So a division that was once a laughing stock, you could argue in the last couple of years, particularly with the Houston Texans becoming good, which makes sense considering how many years they've been drafting so high. You have to hit on some of those picks, and they have. They're a good team. I think the Colts are a pretty solid team. They competed for a playoff spot. The Jacksonville Jaguars had a struggle, and Titans got to figure it out. So, yeah, the AFC South is now considered a rough and rugged division. You have to say so, right?
I would agree, actually. I think that it's not going to be – and then football's weird in general where – teams that are up 1 year might be down the next year. It's very hard to sustain success. But I do think that it's interesting to look at particularly the Colts, the Houston Texans, and the Tennessee Titans because they're all sort of in that similar building phase where they've, you know, got a second-year quarterback. And then obviously you have the Jaguars who are going to see that final year of Trevor Lawrence's rookie contract where they're kind of up against it as well. I'll let Jimmy take it away from there.
Yeah, Nubias. From the Brian Callahan addition, as you mentioned, them bringing him in the offseason to lead things and the departure of Mike Vrabel accompanied with the departure of Derrick Henry, but the addition of Tony Pollard, and you highlighted Calvin Ridley there as well. I know so much of it in this league comes down to what does Will Levis do to be able to bring this offense together, but those are some high quality, even with solid quarterback play with Joe Burrow upright, those are some high quality offenses, and Brian Callahan has made a name for himself around the NFL because of it during his time as the OC in Cincinnati. How different from a play style standpoint, especially on the offensive end, is this going to be both for Titans fans and the league with Callahan at the controls?
From what I said, it's going to be very different. I mean, keep in mind, look, when you have a guy like Derrick Henry, who, by the way, I think is going to do very well in Baltimore, you put him with that quarterback and what they already have there, ooh, buddy, watch out, son. That's going to not be fun. That won't be pleasant, all right? But that being said, it wasn't working with the Titans anymore. they have to move on. You know what I'm saying? And I think that the way they're doing it, the way they're going more modern with the two-back system, maybe even a third back getting there, spreading it out with the receivers. They probably still need another receiver on top of the two they already have. Also, don't forget they made good moves with the DBs. I mean, they got two of the better DBs in the draft with Owuzie and Legarius Sneed. So they've made a lot of traction in free agency. I don't think this is going to be a bad team, but also it's a tough division. Oh, and then by the way, look at who the AFC South is playing this year. So I tell that to say, Levis, it's going to ride on Levis this year. How good is he? I mean, and it's also interesting. I covered Levis when he was at Penn State before he transferred to Kentucky. Okay? And so seeing his maturation go from a guy who was mostly a running quarterback to someone who developed his pass at Kentucky, and now can he put it all together? And I think there's a chance he can, but, hey, man, it's a tough league. But as my man James said earlier, that's the beauty of the NFL. It is designed for teams to get good quick or get bad quick, and it can change fast. So, I mean, right now there's a lot of questions about the Titans. I want to see what they do in the draft, how they go about that. But, I mean, hey, man, they're on the rise. It's going to be a much different scene. You're going to see more three and four wide receiver sets. You're not going to see it being one running back getting 25 carries like you did with Derrick Henry. You're going to see maybe, you know, Spears maybe get a good 10, Pollard maybe get a good 8 or 9 carries. And then also you're going to see the receivers out of the backfield catching the ball more. It's going to be much different. And don't be surprised if you see the receivers go out. I mean, excuse me, you see the running backs go out wide too on certain plays. So, because these two running backs can also run pass routes. So it's going to be a much different offense.
Where does their board sit at 7? The last time I looked, it had them taking Joe Alt, the offensive tackle out of Notre Dame. Is that what they're looking for, is interior protection at that spot at 7? Or do you envision it being a more playmaking style pick, or do they take care of that in the offseason to this point?
You know, it's a very interesting thing, right? I think most – I just saw today, I think – I literally just wrote this. Nearly 60% of mock drafts, which, again, they're mock drafts. None of us are in these rooms. So we have to take that with a grain of salt because we're not in these rooms. But they have Joe Alt going. The consensus is the Titans need a left tackle. I mean, they were one of the worst pass protection offenses last year. The assumption is you get the best offensive tackle when you take Joe Alt. That is the assumption. However, Brian Callahan has said he typically prefers playmakers. Also, keep in mind, my colleague Teron Davenport of ESPN wrote about how when Callahan was in the situation when they could have taken Jamar Chase or Penei Sewell, they went with Jamar Chase. Seemed like that worked out pretty good for the Bengals when Callahan was offensive coordinator there. So maybe you look at a receiver. Also, keep in mind, there's other teams who need tackles too. You know what I'm saying? And the Chargers need a tackle. They need receivers too. They also need a tackle. The New York Giants also need a tackle, but they also need a receiver. So let's say the Chargers take all at 5. Then maybe the Titans have to go with one of the receivers, Neighbors or Odunze. I like Odunze if it were me, but that's just me. So I say all that to say, or hey, maybe they go tight end with Brock Bowers because there are people who believe they can go that route because they only really have like one really good tight end. You get a guy like Bowers because of a security blanket for Levis. I know taking a tight end that high is unusual, but have you seen Brock Bowers play?
I have. And trust me, around here, if he goes that early, then it becomes, oh no, where are the offensive weapons going to come from the Colts? Because believe you me, it'd be nice to have one solid tight end. I would like that type of burden to be had on the Colts. James, go ahead.
So, Nubias, you know me. I like my pettiness. I like my arguments. I like my debates. And so, how do you envision the Michael Pittman Jr. Legarius Sneed matchup going? And, you know, they're both good players, great players, and they will inevitably, one will win a rep, one will lose a rep. But I do want to ask, how do you think whatever fan base will react depending on who wins that matchup and that game because of all the smoke and mirrors that were involved with, you know, Legarius Sneed to Indianapolis with him ultimately ending up in Tennessee?
Hey, man, this is why I watch football. Let's just be real. I mean, it's the pettiness. It's the backbiting. It's the fun stuff. And, yeah, no, it's going to be a show. And this is why we do this. This is why those of us who are able to get credentials to these games, to have the access to tell the stories to these fans, you know, we live for this. Let's just be real. I mean, it's like, you know, rolling around in the mud with a pig, right? You get dirty, the pig likes it. And that's what this is going to be. I don't know, because, I mean, both those guys are elite talents, man, which is what makes the NFL so special. I don't think people realize how good the NFL is. Okay, how good these guys are. But then you talk about two of the best at their position going against each other twice a year. This is what makes it fun. This is why divisional play matters. And again, this is an AFC South that, 2 years ago was pretty much the worst division in football, right?
Yeah.
Now you're looking at a division that every team has something interesting. The Colts have a bunch of interesting players. The Jaguars have some interesting players. I think the Titans now have some interesting players. And obviously, the division champion Houston Texans, who for 5 years were pretty much the worst team in the league, all of a sudden have the best young quarterback. This is fun, guys.
Yeah, it's a great time to be able to be a part of it and cover it for sure. You mentioned it all coming down to Will Levis, and that's basically the barometer that we get from Indianapolis from afar in terms of where things are in Tennessee. I realize this only happens if Levis fails, and I wasn't trying to Freudian slip there and ask about Malik Willis. It's about the other quarterback.
What happens
with Mason Rudolph in all of this? Like, what is it? Is he just the, hey, go out there, Levis failed, but it's time to look towards 2025 draft boards now. Have fun, kid. Like, what is Mason Rudolph's role within that depth chart?
Well, I guess I can mention both. I would say Mason Rudolph is probably going to be the number two quarterback on the depth chart. Malik Willis, I think he's a nice young man. I don't know him, so I always try to be careful how I speak about people who I don't know.
Sure.
From what I've been told, it just ain't working. You know what I'm saying? It just isn't working. Whatever it was he did at Liberty under Hugh Freeze did not translate to the NFL, and he has not picked it up. It's a shame. I don't think he's a bad human being or anything. It just hasn't worked. That being said, Mason Rudolph, hey, look. He has actually started NFL games and won some, okay?
Yeah.
Tangibly, and you can point to that. You can point to things he does that says he is a viable NFL quarterback. Would I want him as my starter? No. But, like, if the Levis thing doesn't work, and like you said, that this is a scenario, which wouldn't be good for the Titans. I'm sure for the Colts and everybody else it would be great, but for the Titans it would be awful that they have to go draft another quarterback next year or the year after, then, yeah, you can go to Mason Rudolph and basically tell him, hey, keep it on the road and do the best you can. I mean, you could have Mason Rudolph as a viable NFL backup quarterback who can start games. Absolutely. Is he a face of a franchise guy? No. But is he a legitimate, viable quarterback? Yes. And let's be real, how many of those exist in America today?
Good question.
I'll wait.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a good point. I just feel like what you mentioned is true. If Levis fails, I just look at franchises and I'm tired of the Band-Aid approach, right? Like the idea of them fixing it by going to get a veteran quarterback next year and do the whole cycle over and over again, like I'm past that. I feel like Titans fans are probably past that, to the point that the most logical thought would be if Levis doesn't work, it's going to happen through the draft, right?
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, but in the meantime, I mean, quarterbacks get hurt, man.
Sure.
I mean, things happen. I mean, also, Levis, the way he plays, man, I mean, have you watched him play? He runs a lot, and he doesn't really fly a whole lot, man. I mean, he got hurt last year. So, really, to be honest, in today's football, you need a viable backup quarterback who you know you can plug in there, you know can learn the offense, you know can get you a win if you need one. Like, you just have to. I mean, I don't think you can be a good NFL team and not have a viable backup. But if the Levis thing doesn't work, period, or he gets hurt or whatever, yeah, you can tell Mason Rudolph to keep it on the road for a while until you figure out what your next option is going to be. Like I said, do I think Mason Rudolph is going to be, you know, the next Joe Namath or, you know, Peyton Manning? No, of course not. I mean, because if he was going to be, he would be by now. But do I think that if you have to, you can make it work with him for a while? Sure. Because, I mean, that's the NFL, man.
So, Nubias, I appreciate the time, my brother. I will see you later this year when I'm in Nashville or when you're obviously in Indianapolis. Looking forward to seeing you, my man, and keep up the great coverage.
Hey, same here, man. Thank y'all.
Again, that is Nubias Wilborn, covers the Titans for alltitans.com/Sports Illustrated.